Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Citizens United connoisseurs, take note. The Supreme Court today is hearing oral arguments in yet another case about campaign contribution limits, and it's just one of many blockbuster cases of the term, which will include cases on abortion rights, affirmative action, public prayer, and presidential power. The new term began yesterday. My guest has written a new book about how politics has played into the big decisions of the Roberts Court, now 9 years in. He is Harvard Law Professor Mark Tushnet, and the book is called In the Balance, Law and Politics on the Roberts Court. Professor Tushnet, welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
Thank you. Good morning.
So let's start with the campaign contributions case being argued today. How is this case different from the Citizens United case, the case which has really defined the Roberts Court to such a degree?
Citizens United involved what's known as independent expenditures, the amounts of money I can spend on my own in support of somebody I approve of without coordinating it with the candidate. And the court there said the First Amendment meant that basically Congress couldn't limit the amount of money people could spend independently of campaigns to support candidates. The case being heard today, that's known as the McCutcheon case, involves limitations on contributions to candidates. In Citizens United, the court said the only reason for limiting spending on campaigns, the only constitutionally permissible reason, is to avoid corruption defined as I give you money and then you vote for something that I want. So it's a trading money for votes. Contributions, direct contributions to candidates, do raise the issue of that kind of corruption more directly. But the issue in the McCutcheon case is a peculiar one. Congress has limited the amount of money you can give to an individual candidate so that you can't give so much that it would be corrupting. And let's say it's $2,000 per candidate. Mm-hmm. It's also said that there's a total or aggregate limit on the amount you can give. So let's say that's $50,000. What that means is that you can give $2,000 to each of 25 candidates. What McCutcheon says is that I want to give $2,000 to 60 candidates. That would to 30 candidates. That would make it $60,000, and therefore more than the aggregate limit. But what McCutcheon says is, look, if it's not going to corrupt the first candidate I give $2,000 to, how is it going to corrupt the 30th candidate I give the same $2,000 to?
I understand. And I wonder what case will come next if this one is approved by the court, if the plaintiffs win their case, because it seems like a systematic dismantling of limitations on political contributions. They open up independent contributions. Then they make the argument that individuals shouldn't have to give to independent groups. They should be able to give directly to candidates if the other thing is okay. And so if this gets approved next, it will be a fundamental challenge to the idea that it's corrupting to give a lot of money to an individual. You think?
There's no question but that the conservative majority on the Roberts Court is very skeptical about the regulation of campaign financing. They're skeptical about the idea that there is corruption from contributions. They're skeptical about the idea that it's a bad thing or the amount of money being spent on campaigns discourages ordinary people from participating in politics. They
think it's freedom of speech.
Right. And in some sense it is, but, you know, I think what supporters of campaign financing regulation say is that we do have to balance these concerns for freedom of expression against having a viable system of politics where ordinary people can feel represented. And huge amounts of money in campaigns undermine that.
If the thesis of your book is that politics really does shape how cases are decided on the high court, has anything changed about the politics since Citizens United, which was almost 4 years ago, to suggest that this case might come out differently, the one they're hearing today?
So there's nothing about the political environment or the sort of deep constitutional visions about what the First Amendment means that has changed. I do think the fact that the case involves contributions makes it different both in law and in sort of high politics about how you ought to think about it. I'd be surprised if in the short run even the conservative majority said billionaires can give half of their wealth to a single candidate. There, the specter of corruption would be just too much for
them. But that's not this case.
No, but that right. So then the question is, well, how far back from that are they going to see this case? And my guess is that they will see this case as more like an impermissible restriction because it's only $2,000 to
each individual. So the surrounding politics wouldn't have changed. And to this thesis, your central thesis that politics really does contribute at least to how cases are decided, I wonder if in the case of Citizens United, it's not also the other way around, that the court ruling in Citizens United, which unleashed, you know, all that so-called independent campaign spending, has helped to create today's gridlock crisis regarding the government shutdown and default threat.
There's no question but that our system of campaign financing and the Supreme Court decisions defining the constitutional boundaries of that system do provide a structure for the kinds of politics that we have. There is an interaction between the court's decisions and how elections are run, and then how elections are run and the outcomes that we're seeing. I think it's worth saying, though, that the empirical evidence on the effects of Citizens United is quite mixed. It's not entirely clear that the Citizens United was partisan in a narrow sense, designed to help the Republican Party. It's just not clear that that's how it's worked out. It is partisan in the sense that liberals think that regulating campaign finance is good or permissible, and conservatives are very skeptical about it. But whether that breaks down in terms of favoring Republicans in elections is much less clear.
My guest on WNYC is Harvard Law Professor Mark Tushnet. His new book is called In the Balance, Law and Politics on the Roberts Court. And if you have any comments or questions about law and politics on the Roberts Court, 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. I want to play a clip of Justice Sotomayor, who was on the show last year, and I asked her about whether she thinks the Supreme Court is political and whether justices vote on cases based on their politics rather than on some neutral sense of being, you know, a neutral umpire, if there is even such a thing. And here's her answer.
The case comes to us because there's not a clear answer. And we have these principles that tell us how to look at the question. And in any one situation, judges can apply the same principles, but in a different order. And so the answer comes out different for some of us. And that's the complexity of what we do. It is not based on politics. It's based on our judicial approach.
I found that such a fascinating answer by Justice Sotomayor, Professor Tushnet. She said it's not based on politics. It's based on our judicial approach. And my question is that a distinction without a difference? Is judicial approach politics by other means once you become a judge?
There is a distinction that I think Justice Sotomayor is trying to get at. I'm not sure that I would put it the same way that she does. I would say that the court does not make decisions in general based on sheer ground-level partisan politics. Will this favor Republicans or will it favor Democrats? When I say that, I always have to say, but it happened that way in Bush against Gore.
But not but I don't even mean political in that sense. I mean political in the sense of somebody's values who's appointed by a Democratic president are likely to, be that the Citizens United case was wrongly decided because limiting campaign spending to even the playing field during campaigns is a more important political value than the right of any rich individual to give as much as they want, or that a woman's right to choose on abortion is more important than the life of the fetus. You know, those kinds of things, which are political without being strictly partisan.
Right. And I think that's what Justice Sotomayor was referring to when she used the words judicial approach. I think she was referring to a kind of what I would call political vision or ordering of values that is associated with different parties in our system. And it manifests itself because Republican presidents nominate judges who have a vision consistent with a conservative view of government.
But that's still politics, right?
It's
still politics to say, listen, I think gay people should be allowed to get married. You look at the Constitution through that lens. That's different than saying, for example, I don't think the Constitution has anything to say about abortion one way or the other, but I want women to be able to have that right. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. It's just whenever you write about politics in the Supreme Court, you have to be careful to distinguish between partisan politics, which I really don't think plays a role, and this politics understood as a broader vision of how our government ought to be organized. The latter always is present in the Supreme Court. It's just that Supreme Court justices actually have an interest in concealing the fact that that can be called politics. So what Justice Sotomayor does is call it a judicial approach. What Justice Scalia does is call it a judicial philosophy. But it is ultimately, from anybody else's point of view, politics.
Has Chief Justice Roberts, in your opinion, acted as an umpire, as he said he would in his confirmation hearings, just calling balls and strikes, nothing more? You say that his court is reshaping legal precedent through decisions unmistakably, though not always predictably, determined by politics as much as by law. You write that in the book.
So the answer is, even he thinks that he went too far in describing the umpire role. But if you want to think of it as the court as an umpire, it's a court that really quite strikingly always calls the close cases in favor of the home team. That is, they are articulating on the whole and across a wide range of areas a conservative vision of the Constitution. The footnote here is, but not with respect to gay rights. And that's because of Justice Kennedy's idiosyncrasies, I think.
As a swing voter in a 5-4 situation.
Right.
And on the unpredictability, because you wrote decisions unmistakably, though not always predictably, determined by politics, how about the Affordable Care Act, in which Justice Roberts sided with the liberals to uphold most of the essential pieces of that legislation? Do you think that decision was shaped by politics?
I have an analysis of Chief Justice Roberts' vote in Citizens United, in the Affordable Care Cara case, in which I end up saying I actually think that the best explanation for how he voted was that he was calling balls and strikes. That is, that he came to a conclusion about what he thought the law required, and it ended up that the law required that he uphold substantial parts of the Affordable Care Act. And that's the sort of unexpected role or time that consideration of law actually can make a difference.
So I think this may go down as a decision that was more mixed than a lot of the conversation about it reflected at the time, because he upheld the individual mandate as constitutional, but he allowed states to opt out of the Medicaid expansion. And we see now that that's, at least at the moment, going to lock out tens of millions of poor people who would otherwise qualify for Obamacare but don't qualify for Medicaid.
Again, it's worth noting, I don't know how much emphasis to put on it, that Justices Kagan and Breyer also joined his opinion on the Medicaid expansion part. So there the breakdown was not conservatives versus liberals. It was all the conservatives and a couple of the liberals against the remaining liberals.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River, New York and New Jersey Public Radio, with our guest Mark Tushnet, Harvard Law professor and author of the book In the Balance, Law and Politics on the Roberts Court. And you use the phrase the Kagan Court, and that Justice Kagan is in a battle with Justice Roberts for intellectual dominance on the court. And she was the dean of Harvard Law, so maybe you knew her. But why do you single her out as the counterpoint to Roberts and not Sotomayor or Ginsburg or Breyer?
The answer is a combination of that she has a distinctive combination of intellect and personality. All of the justices these days are actually quite bright, but she and, on the other side, the Chief Justice are quite outgoing people.
You sound surprised that so many justices are quite bright. Was it not always the case?
It wasn't always true.
We're talking about the Supreme Court here.
Right. No, it wasn't always true. Intellectual smart is not the only thing you want on a court. And so to say that they're all quite bright is not to say, well, this is the ideal court to have. But you can't it's hard to distinguish among the justices in terms of who is the smartest or who's smarter than another one. They're all very smart.
Right. But you were going to make a point about Kagan.
About personality, which is that to be a leader on the court, you have to have some vision, conservative or liberal, as Roberts and Kagan do, and a personality that makes you an attractive person for the other four or five people that you have to deal with. It's a very small group of people. It's only nine people. And they're there interacting over a long period, year by year. And so somebody who is easy to get along with, who makes it sound, well, yeah, of course a sensible person would take the position that I'm taking, becomes a leader more readily than somebody like, say, Justice Breyer, who articulates very complicated positions, or Justice Ginsburg, who is personally quite shy, not outgoing.
How about Justice Scalia, by that measure, who is such a lightning rod for the public one way or the other? What about among his peers?
I think from the outside, strikingly easy to get along with. He's friendly with everybody. And they've apparently, they're able to say when he does one of his opinions that is written in these scathing terms, oh, that's just Nino being Nino. Don't take it seriously. Don't take the passion of it or the vitriol in it seriously. And I suppose that's the way, you know, really mature people would respond to that kind of thing.
Before you go, any other case this year that you're really looking at as potentially defining of the Roberts legacy?
Well, I'm interested in seeing what they do with the case about the president's power to make recess appointments, to appoint people to agencies when Congress is out of session, because it will reveal something about how the conservatives think about presidential power when the president they're thinking about is not a Republican president, but Barack Obama.
Harvard Law Professor Mark Tushnet, his new book, In the Balance, Law and Politics on the Roberts Court. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.